Welcome to the Applied Blockchain Podcast, where blockchain technology and innovation are in the spotlight. My name is Adi Benari, and I'm the founder and CEO of Applied Blockchain, and I'll be your host as we dive into relaxed conversations with industry experts and thought leaders to get their views on what they're building, the Web3 ecosystem, and its transformative impact on the modern world. Ronit Ross, welcome to the Applied Blockchain Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Before I let you introduce yourself, I'll say a couple of words about how we met. You know, obviously running a blockchain company, I have to explain blockchain to people, or have done over the years, and I have all sorts of analogies for that. If I have to explain Ronit Ross to people, I would use the word quantum, right? and my rationale there is that I met you in Hong Kong, but I think at the same time you were in Dubai and in London. So I think you have this ability of like being in several states at the same time.
That is very good. That is very good. Did you make that up recently or did you have that in your head for a while?
I thought of it last night.
Last night? Oh my God. I hope you're not just thinking about me last night. It makes me more exciting than that.
Well, you know, this is my wife is always like, you look like you're thinking about something. What is it? And you know, in this case, it was you.
Wow. I'm both touched and flattered and somewhat worried. I'm somewhat worried, but we did indeed meet in Hong Kong. Actually, it's funny you say quantum. That's a very sophisticated way of saying like what other people say, which is they never know where I am. And as people know, some people who know me, my friends know my LinkedIn handle is onboard A380, and so is my Twitter handle. It's Ron at A380.
There you go. Very good. So on that, Ronit, maybe introduce yourself to the audience. I think for maybe people that. Whatever reason, I haven't been in one of these places that you're at.
Sure. My main avatar is I run a think tank for Citi, call it a research institute focused on the future of finance. So I run the finance vertical. We set this up about 3 years ago. We also have verticals looking at other subject matters run by colleagues of mine, most of whom have like a similar amount of experience, 20 plus, sometimes 25 plus years experience in the domain. Up to 3 years ago, I ran global banks research and was co-head of fintech research at Citi. And through that, I've begun doing a lot of work on digital assets, crypto, also just how finance is changing, not just through the crypto lens, but that was one of the lenses I was looking at. I ran global banks research from 2009 onwards at Citi. And with Citi's blessing, I have a few other avatars. I am an advisory partner at a couple of VCs. One's a Web3 VC here in Dubai. One is an all-sector agnostic Africa-focused VC where I'm in a fintech advisor. Imperial College Business School back in London, which is probably my home for the longest period of time in my life. I sit on their Financial Technology Center advisory board, and on and on and on. I'm zooming in from Dubai this sunny early evening in Dubai, which is where I've been based now since 2016, though I spend... Yeah, seemingly a lot of time on planes, and I've been out meeting a few, some of our corporate clients here, which is why I've got a nice jacket on and a smart shirt on. I won't stand up, but it's a relatively, I think there's jeans under the table, but it's a relatively smart outfit today. Some days I look more like you. Some days I, look like this. Once in a while, I try to, it doesn't fit anymore. I try to get a tie on if I'm seeing a central bank governor or whatever, or a senior politician. But since COVID, we got rid of business cards and these tie things. But even my dress sense, I guess, is quantum. Sometimes, I'm in a full suit, and sometimes I'm in the kind of stuff you're wearing. Not t-shirts, because middle-aged guys don't look so good in t-shirts.
I've got the branded. There you go. So you've got
the corporate swag, right?
Uh-huh. You have a quantum wardrobe.
I have a quantum wardrobe. Yeah, it's a quantum everything. I even have these cool glasses, these new Meta Ray-Ban glasses, which sort of add to my kind of, Inspector Gadget type. I often do my phone calls through these nowadays, and then people are like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "This is the start of the metaverse, the extended reality world. It's coming." And they're like, "Go away, leave us alone."
So Ronit, I guess one of the things in all of the experiences that you described and the types of organizations you're involved in, obviously Citi, but then a lot of startups and a lot of different locations as well.
Yeah.
It gives you like a real, of an extremely broad view.
Yeah.
And probably quite a unique view on different things that are going on. I'm assuming this is what led you to put pen to paper.
Sort of, yeah. The book very much reflects, as you called it, my quantum state, because People who read the book, and there are one or two, mainly my friends and family, but people who read the book say what struck them while reading the book is just how truly international it is. A lot of these books tend to be written naturally through the lens of, say, the US, New York, or the Valley, or a particular location in Europe, like London, or in Asia. What I've tried to do is look across multiple geographies and time zones, because if there's a theme in the book, I think there's several underlying themes, but one theme in the book is about how innovation and new stuff that's being built in this next generation of finance and technology is being built in the periphery, or what used to be called the periphery is becoming the center, or a string of centers. One of the topics we look at in the book is why is London still such an important financial center? And there's a lot of reasons, historical and so on, but we really zoom in on the foreign exchange market and the offshore dollar market, the international dollar market, which is basically traded in London. Most of the bonds issued in international bonds or international loans get signed in London, or registered in London. So London was this like amazing center for international capital in the TradFi world, as we call it, or the offshore dollar 1.0 world. What we're arguing in the book is there's so much amazing change and innovation happening, whether it's in here in the UAE and in India, in China and Brazil. And we go, you know, even in Moscow. I mean, I know politically in the West now, we don't like talking about Russia, but one of the stories in the book we talk about is the creation and building of Tinkoff, arguably along with Nubank and a few others, one of the most successful digital banks of the last decade. This happened in Moscow. From professional managers and technologists, but the entrepreneur had made his money in consumer products, in beer and alcohol. And, you know, he built a digital bank and was a category killer in many ways in Russia. Same happened in Brazil with a few institutions we look at. And so the book is trying to be truly global because interesting stuff is happening not just in the US. No disrespect to the US. A lot of people might think my kind of comments or my ode to globality is like an anti-UK or anti-US comment. The US is still the world's largest source of capital, talent. One of the things we say in the book is don't count the US dollar out, don't count the US out. But there's also interesting things happening elsewhere. And what used to be called the periphery is becoming the center. But I guess in quantum, there is no center, is there? I don't know. I'm not good enough on quantum to know if there's a center in quantum. I assume there isn't. You take us out of this bloody rabbit hole, so you tell me.
But first of all, I think you know, everything you've said obviously comes across in the book. So the book is the chapters, some of them are by region, which I think is great. And as you say, it kind of lets you, it takes you on a journey of things that have happened by region. Because I think quite often in fintech, and I'm guilty of this myself, with the, you know, obviously with a focus on blockchain, we're coming at it from the technology lens. This is the technology, this is what it could do, right? And you're coming at it from a very different angle. Actually, stuff is really interesting stuff and really meaningful, impactful things have happened in very meaningful numbers as well, in incredible transformative numbers and change that happened in financial technology. These are the stories, and it's not a tech-first story, right? It's not this tech has come along and, you know, it has all this potential. It's this stuff's already happened, right? So I think it's very interesting, you know, obviously the journey in China with the super apps and the QR codes and so on, and just the leapfrogging that happened there. And then the same thing with India, with the India stack. It's super interesting. And I've heard you speak at events as well, where, you know, where some people are telling you, well, blockchain has the can bank the unbanked. Well, look at what happened in India without it, right?
I get quite allergic. I get an allergic reaction when some of my more crypto native friends get very excited about the inclusion aspect of blockchain. It's for sure on the edge cases, like in parts of Central Latin America and parts of the Middle East. In the war in Ukraine, there have been amazing use cases of blockchain technology moving value and money. But then they kind of over extrapolate that and say, well, it's going to be like, look, we need this for inclusion. I would say, look what happened in India. And this, I can't remember what chapter it was the book. Was it 4 or 5? And
at the beginning, I think after
chapter five, FinTech in India, Showtime. We have a section in chapter 5 where we talk about the JAM Trinity. JAM is the acronym about, so Jandan, Aadhaar, Mobile. Jandan is like low cost, low frills, no frills bank accounts, government policy. Aadhaar is digital identity card. Mobile is obviously cheap data and the ubiquity of mobile phones. And the one stat that I love, a dozen years ago, start of the 2010s, only 25% of Indian women have a bank account. By the time COVID hits India, before the, 2017, 2018, 75%. There's a 3x increase during a single decade, driven by cheap data, ubiquity of mobile phones, government policy on bank accounts, and, basically having a digital identity program. Now, there are problems and critics and challenges in the digital identity program in India, like anything, and it's arguable that some of these bank accounts don't actually do much, but it's still better than not having a bank account. And you look at neighboring Pakistan, where it's a fraction of that, and there's so much potential in that country, that there's such a lot of women and men without formal financial services access. So one of the things we argue in the book is that your quantum point applies. It's like, yes, you can believe at one moment you can believe that, hey, blockchain helps with inclusion, but you can also believe the traditional rails can do amazing. Billions have been included in China and India, traditional rails. And that ability to hold those two thoughts at the same time is, I think, one of the things hopefully that comes out in the book. Now, of course, if you're a true believer in crypto or a high priest of the fiat system, you look at me and go, that guy can't make his mind up. And I'm happy with that. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with people saying, I don't know what you are.
That was one of my conclusions from the book, actually, was you're telling the stories. And they're very interesting stories because you get to see them, as I said, you go to all these places, you meet all these people, you get an angle on these stories and exposure to them that maybe don't in the same way. But what you haven't done in the book is you're not prophesizing, right? I was kind of expecting that maybe you'll say, well, this is because the title of the book, Future Money, you'll be telling us where it's all going. And actually, you hold back a little bit. You tell us this is, you kind of leave it to us a little bit, right? This is all the stuff that's moving right now.
Yeah.
The potential it has, right?
No, it's a good point. And if you wanted to critique the book, particularly given the title is called Future Money, there are many ways to critique the book. The book is far from perfect. But one way to critique the book is to say, like, hey, but what's the prognosis? What's the conclusion? What's the diagnosis? What should we do? And what we're saying in the book is, particularly in the three final chapters, are forward-looking, is we say, here's what blockchain is doing, both in terms of crypto native, digital native, and in terms of Web 2.5, like TradFi getting into digital assets. This is what's happening, and this is the direction of travel, and this is why it's accelerating. So I hope we make the case, or we make the point in the book, that we are in this acceleration phase of the adoption of digital assets and blockchain technology. We also say, one of the things we say in the book is we're in the early stages, and I think I was waving around my Meta glasses earlier. We're in the early stages of this shift to extended reality. I was in a meeting earlier today with a very senior corporate executive here in the UAE, and he said, we had someone in a few years ago talking about the metaverse. I said, what happened to that? And he said, was that you, Ronit? I don't think it was you. I kept quiet. Obviously, it was me. It was another failed prediction. But it wasn't a failed prediction. He probably read it as a failed prediction because he, like most practical, sensible people, are trying to deliver something this year or next year. And what I was talking about, and I'm talking about in the book, but I'd been talking to him a couple of years ago, is that the direction of travel, and most likely in the late 2020s, 2030s, is we're going to be in a world that our children are already in. So in the start of the book, we talk a lot about how new innovation ideas happen because people moved around and, you sail around in boats or went down the Great Silk Road or whatever. Now you don't need to move around.
Or Kubla Khan said to them, use this money or I'll kill you.
Yes, there is a section here. There's a chapter title where we actually have, we quote Kublai Khan. And that's the definition of, chapter one, use this paper as money or I will kill you. that was Kublai Khan in the late 1200s, basically being told, you can't go and fight another war because the treasury is empty, sir. And he was like, who cares the treasury is empty? We have these banknotes that we claim are backed by bronze coins or whatever. Just print the banknotes. You don't need the bronze coins. Screw it. Just do it. I'm the great Khan. And if you don't listen to me, I'll kill you. Now, obviously, fiat money works now based on law rather than threats of punishment by death. But there's an element of, obviously, fiat, which is about political power. And we talk about that in the book. But there's more to fiat money than just political power. It's also, it's what do you do with it that's useful, which is why the dollar is, and you can say, yes, there's inflation and erosion of value and so on, and there's a lot of printing going on. But the dollar has use because somewhere between 50 and 70% of most financial assets in the world are dollar denominated. So if I hold a dollar in my investment account as an individual or a company, I can do a lot of things with it. And anyways, it's same with tokens. If I can do a lot of things with that token, whatever it is, whether it's a meme coin or a Bitcoin, whatever it is, that's the value, is the use. I have a lot of use. So there's nothing intrinsic. It's like you can't say it's backed by something. Because people say, oh, crypto's not, I was hearing this again today, crypto's not backed by anything. And I, what do you think fiat's backed by? It's literally backed by nothing beyond the faith in the credit of the issuer, and I can do things with it. Now, one of the things I was saying, you know, in the book is, at the start, we talk about Kublai Khan, but at the end, we're saying, you don't need to go like traveling up and down the Great Silk Road or go on ships anymore. You just need to go and talk to people of a different generation. So in my case, maybe my kids or my kids' friends or your nephews and nieces, if you don't have kids, and you need to look at what they're doing. Because remember Facebook 20 years ago was used by college students, and now grandmas around the world are basically dominating Facebook. It took a while, but what was cool and for the college kids eventually became for all of us, yeah, and particularly grandparents. Who would have thought that 20 years ago? It's the same with, you know, the 10-year-olds and the 12-year-olds. They're living in a digital-first world and often a digital-only world. So if you're living in a digital-first or a digital-only world, what does that mean? You value a digital thing more than a physical thing. And that's different to when I was a kid, and I'm guessing when you were a kid, or many of our listeners. But if you're in your 20s, but in your teens or even your tweens, I hope you're not listening to this podcast if you're in your teens, and definitely not your tweens. I hope you're not, but hopefully your parents are. I don't know how your reach is. Hopefully your parents are. And so these parents, you know, mom or dad, go and talk to your tweens and your teens. Say, how do they live? And you know this because Christmas, Easter, Eve holidays coming up. What do we buy them as presents? They do some schoolwork. They get a digital token, a digital voucher. Okay, we use sometimes fiat to buy the digital, but then it's the value is being moved in this digital. So one of the things we argue in the book is tokens are a natural use, you know, natural form of money use case in the digitally native economy. And that's different to 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we weren't living in a world where we valued digital goods so much more than physical. We valued physical goods. It was a mix. We're definitely shifting, and we're heading in this. The next 10 years will be just more of this. We're heading in that direction.
Yep. I think one of the things that came across in the book for me, first of all, I think it's just very insightful. However much time you spend in this industry or in fintech or in blockchain and so on, there's going to be something there that you're going to learn for sure, right? Mm. That's true for me. The second thing I'd say is because you're telling all the different stories from the different regions, you get a feel for the complexity. So when I spoke to you before about the predictions, it's actually not that straightforward, because what works in one region, as you say very clearly in the book, isn't necessarily going to translate to another. Right. Mm. Efficiencies and the things that happened in China, for example, with the super apps, the QR code, the central government aren't necessarily something you copy paste into other places. And the same thing with India. So there's a level of complexity there that the regions are not taking up fintech products necessarily in the same way or at the same rate, and so on. And then if I then look at blockchain specifically, there's obviously crypto. Then there's, how do we solve, you know, even if we start tokenizing more and more things, which is, yeah, like we're definitely in the direction of doing, how do we pay for them, right? The delivery versus payment, what does that payment look like, right? And obviously there's central bank money and there's retail and you know, you're closer to this than some. There's still so much optionality out there. There's so many different tangent, you know, directions and that this could take, and it can take in different regions as well, that it is very difficult, I think, to predict at this point in time.
Right. Sorry, was that?
I'm not sure there's a question in that.
I was going to say, did I miss the question?
I guess I'm saying that this is really part of what comes across in the book, is you get, you know, I think it's tempting, like you say, some people are, I don't know, crypto evangelists. So the answer to everything, identity and everything is in crypto, and it's going to take over the world.
Yeah.
I think what comes across in the book is it's a lot more complex.
Yeah. No, as I was saying before, and I love your quantum, the way you defined it is, because one of the things we say is we try to cover through the stories of the founders and the entrepreneurs and the investors, the complexity and diversity of the world. And maybe I've just been to too many countries, or I've just lived too many years. I tend to see all the shades of gray and nuance. And sometimes easier if you're, you know, writing a book or making a pitch, and definitely if you're tweeting, to be clearly black or white, to have these very strong views. And again, that's gonna disappoint people, because this is not a campaigning book. It's a book that's more about saying there's 50 shades of fintech and digital asset gray out there, and they're actually really interesting and colorful. And it's a kaleidoscope of colors. That's probably a better way of saying it than 50 shades of gray. That sounds either very boring or slightly weird, reference something else. But yeah, it's
I'm about to change the rating on the podcast now.
Exactly. No, it's like there's so much out there. As I was using this analogy the other day, food, I love food analogies. And so I've been for many, many years a vegetarian. And if you're a vegan, you'd look at me and go, oh, you can't make your mind up. Like, what do you do with eggs and milk? And you should go the whole hog. And if you're a meat eater, you'd be like, you have no idea what you're doing. And so I guess I like to have a little bit of everything. Or it's like, you know, some days I like Indian food and other days I like Italian food. And some days I like, I'm not sure what English food is, but you know.
No, I'm not sure either.
Yeah, you know, or some days I like Japanese, some days I like Lebanese. And it's just, that's kind of what the book is. It's kind of it's like walking into the food court and having your choice of, well, yeah. Or actually, nowadays, I guess Deliveroo is a better option, you know, model. You know, you're looking at your app and yeah, you can choose whatever. But what the book is trying to get across though is inside all these themes and these big trends and big technological trends, whether it's blockchain or crypto or AI, we try to highlight the human aspect, the aspect of builders. And it's very easy when you're an analyst or an observer or looking at things from the outside to say, well, that's obvious, right? ABC happened, so D happened. Or, well, look, everyone had a mobile phone, so it's inevitable. Mobile phone-based neobanks and fintechs would explode. Or, you know, there's a kind of...
just a narrative.
Yeah, a sort of top-down causality that's obvious to see from the distance. But when you sort of unwrap these stories, you look at it and you go, ooh. Now, maybe it would have happened anyway, but the reason this thing happened was there was a bloody-minded individual who decided to do something that was a bit uncomfortable and who's a little bit crazy, wanted to make a change, and wanted to do something different. I mean, I'm not claiming I'm any kind of entrepreneur. You know, I've worked for big companies. I'm an advisor to startups, but I admire these people who go and want to do something different. I remember when I moved to Dubai, probably the nearest I've done something to big entrepreneurial. Okay, I mean, I did it inside the big bank, but a lot of people said, why are you leaving London? Why don't you go to, I don't know, New York, make money. You know, the US market's huge, go to New York. Or hey, go to Hong Kong. This is back in 2015. Everyone's pitching me Hong Kong. Go to Hong Kong or New York. Or if you want to, why are you leaving London anyway? And I was like, I want to do something different and new. And people didn't understand that move at the time. Now people no longer ask me, why are you in Dubai? Mm-hmm. Or most people don't. Most people ask, how do I get to Dubai rather than why are you in Dubai?
Yeah.
Habibi, come to Dubai. I'm like, please don't. We're full now. It's like the last 3 years of, you know, between COVID and all the Brits showing up and the Russians and the Indians. It's like, and now the Hong Kong and China ancestor, it's full. But that was my very little small version of, or getting interested in back in 2015, 16, about the same time actually as me thinking about my move to Dubai, getting interested in crypto, what we began calling briefly Web3. People be like, why are you doing this? There's like this traditional finance world, stick to that. And then when I began doing, getting interested in Web3, people are like, hang on, but you occasionally, a lot of the time, wear these jackets and work for a bank, like make up your mind. And so people who want purity get kind of, will be confused by the book and by me. They'll be like, what are you? Are you a Brit? Are you brown? Are you a brown Brit? Are you living in Dubai? Are you on a plane? Like, what are you? And so maybe the quantum way of saying it is a perfect way of saying it. It's like, he's, you know.
I think there's a title there for your next book, maybe. There's something there.
Yeah. Actually, the next article, like we need a fawning profile somewhere. The quantum guy or the quantum whatever.
That's very good, wasn't it?
We don't really talk about quantum in the book. So people are going to say, this is ridiculous. You know, you're shilling this quantum theme from Addy, but you didn't talk about quantum in the book very much.
There you go. So there's an addendum or something. Something needs to happen there. Very good. Very interesting. And normally at the end of the conversation, I ask people to recommend a book or something similar, right? Here it's quite obvious. So maybe take us, you know, show us the book, the name, where we can get it.
So it's called Future Money. Not Future of Money or The Future of Money. The main reason is there's lots of books called The Future of Money. So I decided to be really clever by getting rid of the and the off and said Future Money. My wife says it's kind of a boring title. So does my nephew, but like, what does my nephew know? Obviously my, you know, I got to listen to my wife, but what does my nephew know? So he said it's a boring title. And the reason she said it's a boring title, I don't know why he thought it, my nephew, but my wife said is actually, it doesn't really give the flavor of what the book is, which is lots and lots of stories from around the world of people building, experiencing, investing in the future. It starts with a lot of history because I always believe that you don't know where you're going unless you know where you're coming from. So there's a lot of history of money. And it also starts with a lot of history because money isn't as simple as even finance professionals think. In fact, particularly finance professionals think money is very simple. They don't stop and think, what is, you know, behind this? Or what was it like a couple hundred years ago? I was in Hong Kong last week, and I love this question. When I go to Hong Kong, I ask people, where does the Hong Kong dollar come from? Why is it called Hong Kong dollar? And people say, that's a dollar. It's a Hong Kong. What a stupid question is that? Like, you like people pay you for that kind of, and I say, but where does it? And they go, well, the US dollar, right? I mean, we're pegged to the US dollar. And I'm like, you sure? They go, yeah, no, I didn't do the US dollar. It was the Mexican dollar. And they go, what? Mexico? Yeah. Because believe it or not, 170 years ago, when the Brits showed up and bombed a few Chinese ships and then took over what became Hong Kong, the Brits managed to trade. I won't tell you what they were trading because then they'd be in properly R-rated show, but they were trading with the Chinese, selling them stuff, but the Chinese didn't want their money. They were like, keep your pound sterlings. We have our own money. The Spanish silver dollar, which was then by then called the Mexican silver dollar, the eagle dollar. And dollar is actually a word that comes from Germany, German word for silver coins. And there's this amazing thread. Hang on, the German word for a silver coin went by the Habsburgs into Spain. The Spanish ended up in Mexico, because there was so much the world's purest silver in Mexico and Peru. They sailed across the Pacific to the Philippines because the Pope said everything from Brazil east was Portuguese. You had the West, and they just kept going. They kept the Philippines. The whole of the South China Sea and even mainland China become silver-based until the 1930s. And even today, we have a currency in Hong Kong and in Singapore called the dollar, which was originally connected to the Mexican silver dollar. So the world is the world of money is this amazing historical thread, and the future will be the same. And what this book says is, hey, stop and think about that. Yeah. And that maybe makes you think about maybe having an open mind to, rather than just writing off whether it's blockchain technology or metaverse, let's have an open mind. Let's explore that past, present, future with an open mind and through these amazing stories. That's what the book is, available on Amazon and every good bookshop near you.
I think it's very good. It's a very good analysis, because if you want to understand, if you assume that money is going to change, and it certainly looks like technology is changing the nation, then it's obviously very good to understand where it's come from, because you need to understand what you're losing and what you're gaining. Right? In the history, there's certain reasons why things evolved in a certain way, why certain things were taken away. So I think in every step in evolution like this, you need to understand, you know, what's falling by the wayside and why, and what might be the implications of that and so on.
No, absolutely. So yeah, hopefully your viewers, your audience will go and look it up on Amazon or whatever bookshop. This is available in, I know, in Waterstones and a few other big bookshops here in Dubai. The big one in the mall has it. But you might have to look it up online, because it's not yet an epic bestseller. I'm sure it will be with your help, Addy, but you know.
Okay, we'll share a link in the
show. Share a link in the show notes or whatever.
Very good. Run it. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And yeah, look forward to bringing you back in the future and learning more.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to the Applied Blockchain podcast. Make sure you follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter for more updates. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, please let us know by leaving a review and clicking subscribe. Until next time.